Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
That's it. That's all you got. Months of hype, endless speculation, and IPO run-up to end all IPO run-ups. And Facebook is a flop? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Friday, the 18th of May. Good as always to have you with us. And one hardly knows where to begin, to be honest with you. It was a little bit like a day-long IPO train wreck, watching Facebook open at $38 this morning and then close at $38.23 a share. Maybe where we start is with Heidi Moore and John Carney and our weekly wrap there in our New York studios. Hey, guys.
Hi, Kai.
Hi.
So, Heidi, was I a little harsh? Is Facebook a flop or a no-flop?
You were not harsh enough. All right. It was a tremendous disappointment. They should have done much better, and the company was really haughty towards investors. I think karmically that came back to bite it.
John, what do you think?
I don't think it was as bad as Heidi says. I think that we've gotten used to these sort of explosive first days for some of these hot IPOs. I don't think that's healthy for the market. You shouldn't buy into an IPO, you know, hoping to double your money. It's not the lottery. A 10%, you know, 7 to 15% raise is pretty normal.
Yeah, but John, we're in like the single low-digit decimals here for this gain. Come on.
I agree. This was a little surprising to me. Right. I had said I thought it would close, you know, 10%. To 15% higher, not almost exactly where it opened.
Shows what you know. Hey, Heidi, what about the theory that investment banks got it right? Their job is to price the IPO at what the market will bear, and clearly, $38 is what the market will bear.
No, that's absolutely wrong, because the reason it's at 38 bucks.
So glad we called you.
Exactly. The reason it's at 38 bucks is because Morgan Stanley had to come in and support that stock. They had to buy all the shares that people were dumping.
Well, okay, hold on.
That is not the way it should work.
Explain that a little bit, because every time this thing, and I was watching all day, as were a lot of people, every time it got down to $38 even, it somehow miraculously went back up and not down to $37.99. So, John, what were the underwriters doing, the banks that brought this thing to market?
Right. So what they were doing is coming in and supporting the price. They basically just had a limit order and then said, if it gets to 38, we start buying again so that it will never drop below 38. What I don't think they ever expected was to have to buy as much as they did, because this was an epic battle with people trying to sell and, you know, people selling, and the underwriters having to come back in and keep snatching up shares.
All right, so
that's not how you want things to go if you're an underwriter.
Right. Of course. Heidi, what happens? Well, how long can the underwriters keep it up? Right. I mean, on Monday, when people go to sell Facebook, if they do, what happens?
That's it. You've seen it. This is as far as the underwriters go.
Really?
After
wow. Just one day?
I know. And they got $176 million for it.
That's right.
Well, I would say that I expect some support, not the kind of $38, you can't go lower than this support. Yeah. But I do think the underwriters will stop it from dropping too precipitously on Monday. How much after that goes, it's not clear. But they were paid big fees to use their big balance sheets to support this stock. And they're going to keep doing it at least to some extent on Monday.
They created the hype, and they have to eat it.
Well, go to the nuts and bolts of this thing. What happened? Why didn't it, you know, it got up to like $45 at one point, but what happened to keep it where it is?
Well, a lot of people sold. What we saw was that a lot of insiders, people who already owned the shares, were selling out. 57% of the shares were being sold by insiders. They were selling out, and that's always a bad sign for the market. Why don't those people want to stay in? And so that said it. When you see the price dropping, it means more people are trying to sell than there are people available to buy.
One of the things I heard was that a lot of the big institutional buyers who came in to buy, and even some of the smaller hedge funds who bought into the IPO, the standard game is you put in a big allocation and you get cut down to half of that. So let's say you want $75 million of Facebook and you get so you ask for 150, they cut you down and you get 75. What I heard happened to a lot of folks here is they got the full allocation they asked for, which was much more than they ever expected to, so they had to sell.
They had to get rid of it. Yeah. So Heidi, did quickly now, did Facebook get greedy with this, with the $38 and adding shares?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, look, it's nice to be an exception, but it's bad form to consider yourself an exception. And clearly, Facebook had that. They thought they could push this market as far as possible. They tried it, and they came back down to earth. So that's actually a good sign for the market. It shows people are rational.
We'll see what happens on Monday. Heidi Moore, she's our New York Bureau Chief. John Carney is with CNBC. Thanks, you guys. Have a good weekend.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
See you. On Wall Street today, as you might have been able to tell if you were paying attention, it was kind of meh. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Facebook's IPO, no matter where it closed, but the IPO at $38 means there are thousands of new paper millionaires and a couple of billionaires running around Silicon Valley today. Maybe they're not quite as rich as they'd hoped, but there's probably still some Ferrari shopping going on. Or maybe there's not, because a lot of the nouveau tech riche today came of age during the last boom. And kids nowadays, they're looking for a different kind of return on their investment, as Marketplace's Queen of Cam reports.
First things first. Facebook aside, Silicon Valley isn't nearly as rich now as it was during the last tech boom in the late 1990s. Back then, internet stocks were flying so high, just about everyone was throwing money at anything with a .com in its name. Walter Roth is the CEO of Inward.me, a startup that creates mobile apps that inspire.
I experienced the tail end of the .com and had raised about $9 million.
Did you catch that? He said the .com. You hear that shorthand a lot with younger entrepreneurs. For them, the last boom has become a historical event with all the lessons of history.
I think whether you succeeded or failed in the .com, both hit you like a truck. You know, if you made tons of money, there's a lot of personal issues that come with that. And if you cratered, there's a lot of identity issues as well.
Justin Moore is the CEO of Axient, a startup in Mountain View. At 31, he's on his third tech company, and like a lot of today's entrepreneurs, he came of age during the .com at Stanford.
I show up on campus, I'm hearing about people starting companies out of their dorm rooms, day trading, and it's a whole new world.
So Moore drained $5,000 in savings and started day trading.
And it went only one direction, which was up. So bought a Porsche Turbo, very excited. All my friends couldn't wait to drive it. And after a week, I had reached this pinnacle and it was totally empty.
So this time around, the thing to have isn't things, but passion and purpose.
You know, I don't start companies to make money. Now, money is important, but it really has to be about the sense of a greater purpose.
You have the Occupy movements. You have all the talk about the top 1%.
Robert Hendershot is a professor at the business school at Santa Clara University.
And so people don't necessarily want to be associated with the extremely wealthy. And you can hear it in the dialogue. It's about changing the world. It's about, I'm not just in it for the money. I want to do good.
And do you buy it that it is about changing the world, or is it about me?
Well, it's always about me, right? People being modest is what is being respected today.
Welcome to Wisdom 2.0, a conference where the employees of Facebook, eBay, Zynga, and Google talk about how to foster wisdom and courage, all in the service of work.
In the Valley, we like to think that we are doing good and doing well at the same time.
Chet Meng Tang, or Meng as he's known, was an early engineer at Google, and he's also the author of Search Inside Yourself. His goal is to bring world peace by promoting enlightenment in business.
Do you see anybody doing this?
There's this really nice company called Google.
When you mention Google, obviously it's been in the news a lot lately because there's been things that people feel aren't so good.
Yes, but the issue is the company is big and diverse. So there are people at varying stages of consciousness.
Hillary Martin is a wealth advisor in Silicon Valley, and she sees many of these tech entrepreneurs when they become conscious of being rich.
I hear them really talking about how technology changes the world, and they'd really like to be a part of that.
And they do it by becoming angel investors and funding startups in their infancy. Martin warns her idealistic young clients that being an angel is high risk. They tell her, it's not about the money, it's about being part of something. But Justin Moore, you know the guy who bought the Porsche, he says maybe it's not so much naivete as a return to something else.
If you look back, yes, there was ostentation, but there were a lot of titans of technology that were started long before the .com. Look at the original Silicon Valley entrepreneurs, Bill and Dave from HP.
That's Bill Hewlett and Dave Packard, who started their legendary computer company in a garage in 1938 with $500, and it took them nearly 20 years to go public. In San Francisco, I'm Queen of Kim for Marketplace.
Coming up, the 1% and the rest of us.
What a great story that the less taxes I pay, the better off everyone else will be. This is a marvelously self-justifying viewpoint if you're somebody like me. But at the end of the day, it hasn't worked.
And first, let's do the numbers. Well, so much for the Facebook effect, right? The Dow Industrial slumped 73 points today, 0.6%, finished at 12,369. The NASDAQ down 34 points, 1.25%, 2778. The S&P 500 off 9 points, 0.75%, ended at 1295. For the week, and it was by the worst of the year, the Dow unloaded 3.5%. The NASDAQ retreated 5.33%. The S&P 500 down 4.33%. That very bad $3 billion bet cost J.P. Morgan Chase another 1.25% today, wiped out its gains for the year. Morgan Stanley sank more than 0.75% today. Bond prices fell a little bit. The yield on the 10-year T-note nudged up to 1.72%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. World leaders and thousands of protesters converge on Chicago for the NATO summit. In New York, the trial of former McKinsey & Company chief Rajat Gupta begins in a federal courtroom. He's accused of insider trading. And it's National Waitstaff Day. We know money's tight, but if you're dining out, show your server some extra love. I'm Gina Delvac.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Not far from Facebook's headquarters in Menlo Park, California, literally 5, maybe 6 miles down the road, another Silicon Valley company made some news this week. Hewlett-Packard is said to be ready to announce massive layoffs sometime next week. 30,000 people is the number that's being used. CEO Meg Whitman will reportedly use the savings to create new products and beef up HP's sales force, as Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith reports.
Hewlett-Packard might be struggling a little now, but they have a lot going for them, says analyst Mark Fabi with Gartner, Inc.
They're still number one in servers. They're number two in services. They're number one in PCs.
Also, probably number one in CEO turnover. HP has had 3 CEOs in 3 years. Fabi says that instability has taken a big toll on the company.
You know, the way I often sum up HP is that they're less than the sum of their parts. The businesses aren't working closely together and leveraging the collective asset.
In other words, HP doesn't even know how much it has going for it.
Oh, you're so money and you don't even know it.
That's what I keep trying to tell you. So money.
That's from the movie Swingers, where two guys are trying to pump up their friend. So what makes HP so money? For one thing, it's lab. Tech analyst Tim Beharin says he hopes part of the money saved in these layoffs will be funneled into innovation.
They actually have one of the richest labs in the world for technology, and it has been totally underfunded.
More positive reinforcement for HP? All of the servers it makes are perfect for helping companies get up to speed in the current tidal wave of consumer data. Michael Holt is a senior equity analyst with Morningstar.
Consumers see some of this with, you know, the Facebooks of the world, but even the corporations of the world are collecting more data and analyzing more data, and that's where HP is actually fairly well positioned.
Holt says their success will depend on whether they can focus and leverage their strengths. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Honestly, if you were going to dump some bad news on the market, today would be a pretty good day, right? Hiding under cover of Facebook, if you will. Gets us to Walmart. Walmart shares had another good day today after the world's biggest retailer reported better than expected quarterly profits. Never mind that it also told investors it's trying to figure out exactly how well it follows American anti-corruption laws. Marketplace's Bob Moon has that story.
Get used to hearing this if you're a Walmart investor. During his conference call announcing quarterly earnings yesterday, Chief Executive Michael Duke couldn't avoid addressing the bribery scandal involving Walmart's operations in Mexico.
We are working aggressively to determine what happened, and we will take appropriate action if violations of the law or our policies occurred.
He spoke as the company revealed it's widened its investigation to look for possible bribery in countries beyond Mexico, but investors took that news in stride. In fact, as of today, the stock has recovered virtually all the value it lost after the New York Times broke the bribery story last month. At Wayne State University, law professor Peter Henning says Wall Street seems to be more comfortable that the corruption case is manageable, although that could change.
I guess the question is for the market, are there any more shoes that are going to drop?
Even if there aren't, Henning says, Walmart executives could become increasingly distracted from running the company.
Management's going to have to spend a lot of time focusing on this and then, of course, dealing with all the other fallout, public relations, private lawsuits, things like that.
Another expert on the bribery law doubts the case will ever become a real threat to Walmart's business. Butler University professor Michael Kaler says even if the punishment were to match the biggest fine to date,
we're looking at an $800 million fine and penalty. That amount clearly is not material, even though it's a big number, to a company like Walmart,
which reported revenue of more than $400 billion last year. Kaler thinks the biggest damage will be the drawn-out focus on Walmart's ethics. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Well, Facebook was underperforming in New York, but still creating instant millionaires in Silicon Valley. World leaders focused on the other end of the socioeconomic spectrum today. Ahead of the G8 summit this weekend, President Obama said the world's richest country has a moral obligation to lead the fight against hunger and malnutrition. He also said, though, that government can't do it alone and that he's lined up $3 billion from the private sector to help, which in turn raised a couple of eyebrows. From the Marketplace Wealth and Poverty Desk, Chrissy Clark explains.
First, Obama made the announcement about partnering up with companies like PepsiCo and Monsanto to lift 50 million people from poverty over the next decade. But as soon as he made it, he was already anticipating the follow-up question.
I know some have asked, in a time of austerity, whether this new alliance is just a way for governments to shift the burden onto somebody else. I want to be clear, the answer is no.
Gregory Adams with Oxfam says he hopes the president's right. He's one of the people who's concerned that recently there's been a push to get governments out of the way when it comes to food and agriculture problems in poor countries and let private investment solve them instead. That, Adams says, leaves some big gaps.
There are some very basic infrastructure functions that the private sector just has not shown that they can do by themselves. Things like agriculture extension services, roads, consistent water supply.
That said,
Raj Shah heads USAID for the Obama administration.
The private sector brings some incredibly unique technologies and business models that simply can't be replicated by public sector investment alone. Vodafone, for example, is committing to reach 500,000 small-scale farmers with SMS text-based services that would allow them to ascertain local market prices.
That helps farmers negotiate better deals at the market. Shah says the private efforts are meant to supplement the fight against global hunger, not replace it. But ultimately, that'll be up for the world leaders at the G8 conference this weekend to decide. I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
I'm gonna sit right down and write myself a letter.
Before Facebook went public today, thousands and thousands and tens of thousands of hours were spent coding. People, usually guys, writing the programs that would make the Facebook website work. And that, in turn, gets us to our undisputed top letters story of this week about the brogrammer. Young men in high tech and the work culture that they can sometimes create. Jesse Langham is a computer programmer in San Francisco. He wrote in to say, way to go, guys, in getting the story so totally wrong.
As a programmer with social skills, perfect vision, and pockets that never need protection, the coining of the word programmer is quite thrilling to me because the number of stereotypes applied to my profession has increased to 2. I no longer have to explain that I'm not an awkward nerd when I tell people about my work. Now I just have to tell them that I'm not a sexless and tactless frat boy. So thanks for that, Marketplace.
We did get some letters from women who agreed the programmer is alive and well in their workplace. Lisa Schnettler, though, is not one of them. She's been working in IT for close to 20 years, most recently in Jersey City, New Jersey.
These womanizing frat boys that were described as typical IT guys? I've never met one. Sci-fi nuts? Definitely. Sometimes condescending until you prove your bona fides? Sure. But disrespectful of me as a woman? Never.
The economy is, by the broader numbers, getting better, but by each individual situation, not really. Earlier this week, the Government Accountability Office came out with a report saying the number of people 55 and over who are long-term unemployed has soared since the recession started 4 years ago. Thea Bellis from McCall, Idaho, wants to know more about that.
I am 55 and fit this profile. I would love to hear more about how people in my age group are managing. Are they moving back in with their 90-year-old parents? How and what are they doing?
Story ideas always welcome. Praise about and problems with what you hear on the broadcast as well. Write to us letters at marketplace.org. There's a story this week about income inequality in politics and the economy that's gotten a decent amount of buzz. A guy named Nick Hanauer, I should say a rich venture capitalist named Nick Hanauer, gave a TED talk, those 3 or 4, maybe 5 minute big ideas talks that started as part of a conference called Technology, Entertainment and Design, TED. Anyway, they're taped and a lot of them are posted online. But Hanauer's talk from a couple of months ago about how the wealthy like him really aren't the engines of economic growth went viral this week because it wasn't on the TED site. Chris Anderson, who runs TED, said it was too controversial politically. The two of them, Hanauer and Anderson, have had it out. The video is up on the TED site now, so that part's done. But we called Nick Hauer anyway to ask why income inequality raises so many partisan hackles. And we reached him, perhaps appropriately enough, on a private plane. Nick Hanauer, good to have you with us.
It's great to be with you.
So let's stipulate that wealth and poverty in this country, income inequality has become partisan, which it obviously has. The question is, why? What happened to make it this way?
That's a great and very important question, and I wish I had a good answer to it. We became enthralled with the view that wealth trickled down from the top, and that if you poured money into rich people, sort of like an ingredient, prosperity and jobs would squirt out of them like donuts. And you know, if you understand economies in a 19th century way, that view is plausible, and I think a lot of people accepted it. And look, lots of rich people accepted it because it's a super convenient thing to accept, right? What a great story that the less taxes I pay, the better off everyone else will be. This is a marvelously self-justifying viewpoint. But at the end of the day, it hasn't worked. You know, it's kind of been a catastrophe for everybody in the country except people like me. And, you know, I think it's time for us all to sort of look up and reexamine these assumptions and go another way.
When you go out for beers with your friends, who I imagine are in the same socioeconomic strata that you are, what do they say when you say, listen, I think we ought to tax people like you and me more? They must look at you like you have three heads.
Yeah, not a great way to grow your friend group. But in truth, and you could talk to them about it, I suppose when I started to make these arguments, people were angry, but most of my friends have come around begrudgingly. I mean, of course, nobody wants to pay more in taxes. You know, yeah. I don't want to pay more in taxes.
Yeah.
But if you understand how the system works, in a more realistic way, what you begin to see is that in the end, it's better for me. Because honestly, like, what do I care if my tax rate is 15% or 30 if my businesses are growing twice as fast? Prosperity for people like me is a consequence of the number of customers I have, not the tax rate that I pay. If low taxes were the way that capitalists like me created wealth, then we'd be starting our companies in the Congo or Somalia or Afghanistan. But we're not. We come to places where there are lots and lots of customers. While that may hurt a little bit in the short term for people like me, in the long term, it's a huge winner.
What happens now in this whole debate, Nick? I mean, we're heading into an election, and that, of course, is part of the reason why this has become controversial with you and Ted. Where do we go? What happens?
Well, I think that we need to debate this very important issue of where prosperity comes from. If we can come to a more healthy conclusion, which is that it is the middle class and the success of the middle class that animates future and shared prosperity, and begin to invest again in that middle class, and for wealthy citizens like me to begin to pay more of our fair share, I think the future is very, very bright. And I think that you'll see the economy begin to grow quickly again. And I think you'll begin to see the median wage grow again. And I think the country will be in super shape.
Nick Hanauer, we reached him on a plane, as you might be able to tell from the way this sounds. Nick, thanks a lot.
Very pleased to be here. Thank you for having me.
You can see Nick's talk about income inequality on our website. It's marketplace.org. We did call Chris Anderson of TED, by the way. Not interested in talking.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out, which comes with a reminder that Facebook went public today. You might remember a couple of days ago we told you General Motors was going to stop advertising on Facebook because it just wasn't worth it. Now comes news GM might be reconsidering ads altogether, or at least the big splashy ones. GM's head of global marketing told the Wall Street Journal today it's not going to do a Super Bowl ad this year. $3.8 million for 30 seconds, it seems, is just a little bit too rich. All right, that's it. We got to go. That's Marketplace from APM this Friday. Today, the Dow gave back 73 points, 0.6%. The NASDAQ off 34 points, 1.5%. The S&P 500 down 9 points, 0.75% there. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace's acting producer is Megan Larson. The executive producer of the broadcast is Deborah Clark. J.J. Yore is the vice president and general manager. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, come on down.
I've been on two game shows, and I won two rooms of furniture on Wheel of Fortune, and I won a house and three rooms of furniture on Dream House.
You won a house?
A house.
Tess cuts the line at The Price is Right. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you back here Monday. This is APM.